November 1864. London's most notorious prison. Inside, at the far end of the Dead Man's Walk, Franz Müller, a 24-year-old German immigrant, was being readied for the scaffold.
It was a scene that gave a thorough wrench to my nerves. It was horrid.
Müller had been convicted of a crime that shook Victorian Britain to the core, the first murder on a train.
This was a crime which aroused an almost instinctive spirit of vengeance.
This one act of extreme violence had brought to the surface the anxieties Victorians had about the iron road spreading across the land. Müller had come to personify all that seemed dangerous about the new world of steam and speed. But was he even guilty?
I knew Mr. Müller for about 6 months. He was kind. That was how Franz was.
We now reopen the railway murder case. An investigation which becomes a journey into the Victorian mind at the dawn of the railway age.
A black and white photograph of Victorian passengers waiting on a railway platform. BBC, Murder on the Victorian Railway. Daytime in London.
21st century London. Its streets, shiny with glass and steel. Also a city where the past is everywhere.
A man in a long dark coat.
This film brings Victorian London back to life. We recreate documents and images from the first railway murder. We meet the people who became caught up in this sensational crime. The words they speak are taken from court transcripts, letters and reportage, their own testimony and that of other 19th century witnesses. Frederick Wicks was then a young journalist. His search for the truth inspired him to follow this story right to the end. Now, Wicks is our guide, helping us to travel from the present day back to the 1800s.
As news of the murder spread, a feverish fear emerged. It was said that no one knew when they opened a carriage door that they might not find blood on the cushion, that not a parent would entrust his daughter to the train without a horrid anxiety, that not a traveller took his seat without feeling how he runs his chance.
A photograph shows Wicks waiting on a platform, wearing a hat and sporting a beard. Nighttime.
Our investigation begins in Hackney, East London. In the 19th century, a railway ran between this terrace and the main road behind. In 1864, on Saturday the 9th of July at 10:10 p.m, the crime was first discovered right here, as train driver Alfred Eakin later testified.
Eakin's traipsing through the darkness down to the track.
I was on my way and my attention was caught by something on the line. I stopped the engine as soon as possible and backed to the spot where the body was lying. He was lying on his back with his head towards Hackney. He was alive at the time.
Victorian train drivers were the aristocrats of the new steam-powered world. Railwaymen like Eakin were also resourceful. The victim was quickly moved to the nearest available shelter.
I found four or five people to help carry the body. Several other persons also came to help besides those who carried the body. I suppose there must have been a dozen altogether. The body was carried to the public house, the bottom of the railway embankment.
A pub.
then called the Mitford Castle. The pub has since been renamed and remodelled.
Inside the pub.
But behind the bar is a small room that has been left as it was 150 years ago.
Wearing his driver's uniform, Eakin sitting in the pub's back room.
He was lying on the table. I made an examination, his shirt was rumpled and his hat was gone. It was clear that the unfortunate man's skull was broken and he had a severe wound on the side of his head. He was still living but groaning. He was perfectly unconscious.
Did you send for help?
A medical man was sent for.
Eakin puts his hand on the cloth that covers the table as if remembering the incident.
Nobody knew who the body was, nor where he'd come from.
Empty railway platforms at a London Overground station.
Just up the line at Hackney Station, the Victorian tracks are still in use. Here, another discovery was made, at the same time as the bloodied body was found on the tracks.
A train drives through.
A suburban train pulled into Hackney Station. One of the carriages was empty, but stained with blood. From the appearance of the compartment, there had been a foul crime, there could be no doubt.
What conclusion was drawn from the blood-stained carriage when put together with the body that Eakin found?
The unfortunate victim had been assaulted on the train that had pulled in here. He had then been thrown onto the line by his assailant, or had struggled and fallen from the carriage in his endeavour to escape.
The moon shines brightly in the night sky.
The world's first steam locomotive had been built in Cornwall just 60 years earlier. The 1820s had seen the first passenger trains.
A painting of the trains.
By the mid-19th century, thousands of miles of track had been laid. Railway mania had created a network across the whole country. Speed, once a luxury for the few, had become commonplace. Journeys that once took days now took hours. The iron roads were changing how people saw their world.
Passengers leaving Hackney Central Station.
We feel we are approaching almost to the final extinction of space and distance. The surface of our country is shriveling in size. It will soon become not much bigger than one immense city.
In 1864, the power of steam was a thrilling phenomenon. It was also terrifying.
Back at the Top of the Morning pub.
In the early hours of Sunday, the 10th of July, the condition of the victim in Hackney worsened.
A blood-stained letter.
From letters found in his pocket, he was identified as Thomas Briggs. This is his photograph. He was nearly 70. He had a wife and four children. His son was also called Thomas.
I was sent for at 2 o'clock on Sunday morning, the 10th of July. Police constable called. I was told my father was then gravely injured and in the back room of a public house called the Mitford Castle. And naturally, I went there directly. My father was then in a state of insensibility, covered with a blanket, his shirt open at the neck.
Despite the best efforts of a local doctor, old Thomas Briggs died without regaining consciousness. There was no final farewell for his son.
He was affectionate and kind, pleasant, courteous. A fine man, highly respected.
A mantelpiece containing various personal effects, a ship in a bottle, a small black pot, and a framed photograph of Thomas Briggs.
With Briggs's death, this was a murder, the highest and rarest criminal incident. Now, even this had happened in a railway carriage.
A railway worker walks along a dimly lit platform at night. Briggs's son, Thomas, is looking at the photograph of his late father on the mantelpiece.
Though the railway carriage was covered with blood, there was no forensic science to analyse the crime scene, not even fingerprinting. Victorian police had to work with no more evidence than what they could see with their own eyes.
A photograph of the bloodstains on the seats in the train compartment.
The police investigation was led by an up-and-coming detective. Inspector Richard Tanner was described by his colleagues as brilliant.
Tanner opens the door of a first-class carriage and takes a seat.
I went first thing to the works of the North London line. In a shed there was the railway carriage. The door handle was bloody.
And what about the inside of the compartment?
A large quantity of blood appeared to have flowed profusely from the corner seat. There was also a small quantity of blood on the window. Two spots, like splashes. They're about the size of sixpences, and they contain particles of brain matter. I inferred that Mr. Briggs had been sitting in this corner and that he'd fallen asleep, resting his head against the window, and that he'd been struck by someone on the opposite side to the left temple.
This murder appeared to be a sudden and unprovoked attack on a sleeping man.
Medical notes.
The police also had the medical notes of the doctor who tried to save Briggs.
There was a jagged wound across the left ear. In front of that ear, there was another jagged wound. There were also two deep wounds to the temple.
The medical notes suggested to the police how Briggs had ended up on the railway tracks.
A distinction was made between the wounds on the side of the head and those to the temple. Those up above were attributed to some blunt instrument. I think that those wounds on the side of the head were owing to a fall.
You're saying he fell, so it could have been an accident?
Appearances would indicate that the murderer took Mr. Briggs to the door and threw him out.
Footage at a printing factory.
The first railway murder immediately captured the imagination of the public and the press.
It was one of the foulest murders of our time.
A thrill of horror ran through the whole country at news of this murder.
Within seconds would have come the crushing blow. It was the rapidity of the incident, done on a frequented line, that caused alarm in the public mind.
We were face to face with a fact which brought home to our mind with the utmost force the perils of railway travelling.
The new rail network meant that for the first time, newspapers were available all over the country. Huge press empires were being created, and new readerships were often built on the back of true-life whodunits.
A newspaper headline.
A new reading public sprang up under the stimulus of this curiosity. People had to have their papers and learn, even in the farthest village of the United Kingdom, how the case was going.
A train bound for Fenchurch Street pulls in.
The mainline terminus at the heart of the railway murder case was the City of London's Fenchurch Street. 150 years ago, this was the start of a new suburban route called the North London Line. And here, old Thomas Briggs had boarded the train on which he'd ridden to his death.
A train leaves, bound for Southend.
Trains leave Fenchurch Street under a covered way. This was originally to prevent horses taking fright from the noise and smoke of the steam engines.
A map of East London.
Soon after emerging into the open, the Victorian tracks turned north, away from the city. This stretch of the line has now been ripped up, but we do have an eyewitness account from the time.
Alfred's inside the train's cab.
Pass through fields to the four commons. We get to breathe a bit more freely. We've left behind the smoke of the chimneys.
The train's connecting rod moves round with the wheels.
We find ourselves in deep countryside. We've got extensive views right over the Hackney Marshes.
A drawing of Hackney Marshes.
Then on the right rises the tower of the old Hackney Church.
The white tower of Hackney Church.
We have arrived at Hackney Station.
Alfred beams merrily. A modern train pulls into Hackney Central Station.
Hackney Station, where the blood-stained carriage was found, and where Briggs would have got off the train if he'd lived to complete his journey.
Daytime at a neatly kept street opposite a small park.
Nearby Clapton Square was the Briggs family home. In the 1860s, this was one of the smartest addresses in East London.
My father arrived in London from Lancashire as a teenager and got a job in a city bank.
And he'd made a success of his life in London.
He was a gentleman, greatly trusted and respected by his employers, and held in high esteem by a large circle of friends.
The Briggs family home.
From his home here in suburban Hackney, Thomas Briggs had travelled daily to his banking job in the city. He'd been one of London's very first railway commuters.
A colour drawing of a railway carriage.
One aspect of Briggs's commute reveals a great deal about life in Victorian London. He'd always travelled first class, sitting in a private compartment that couldn't be accessed from the rest of the train. In the 19th century, the division between classes was meant to be impenetrable.
The condition we live in is justly regarded as being one of the strangest ever seen in the world. We have more riches than any other nation, and London is full of wealth of every kind. But here, there are also those steeped in the most abject poverty, sinking into the deepest degradation.
Victorian London had no safety net. For those who fell, it was a long way down, to a separate world.
There is no intercourse and no sympathy between rich and poor. They are fed by different foods, they are ordered by different manners, and they are as ignorant of each other's habits, thoughts, and feelings as if they were dwellers on different planets. One can only wonder that the whole crazy fabric still hangs together.
The murder of Thomas Briggs suggested a new fear, that the train was crashing through class barriers.
If we can be murdered thus, travelling first class for a mere step of a journey, we could be slain in our pew at church or assassinated at our dinner table.
Panic was coursing along the rails.
Traffic moves up and down both sides of a wide London street.
Central London's Great Scotland Yard, the original headquarters of the Metropolitan Police. Here, the pressure was on to find the killer as soon as possible.
Inspector Tanner arrives at Scotland Yard. A publication from the time, Police News, has drawings on the front page relating to the murder.
Police investigation of the crime scene produced a promising lead. Inspector Tanner reckoned he had the killer's hat.
We took from the train compartment a bag, a stick and a hat. The bag and stick were both recognised as having belonged to Mr. Briggs, but the hat was not his. Mr. Briggs had been wearing a tall hat and that had disappeared. Well, this hat, found in the carriage, is a black beaver hat, and lower in the crown than the high hat that Mr. Briggs was in the habit of wearing. The hat's crushed, as if it's been trodden upon in a struggle. And the conclusion appeared to me inevitable that the murderer, in hurry and excitement, took the wrong hat. He took Mr. Briggs's hat with him and left his own.
Though inexpensive, the hat was a new look, with a distinctive striped lining, which revealed the maker's name.
A leaflet listing a £300 murder reward.
Eager to find the owner of the half-crushed beaver hat, the police offered a huge reward. £300 was about 5 years' wages for a working man.
I thought, if I could discover the person who wore this hat on that night, I'd have found the murderer.
Initially, the police's handling of the railway murder case was highly praised. In 1864, the Metropolitan Police's detective branch was newly established, so their investigative skills were a novelty.
The acuteness displayed by these detectives on following the threads of intricate plots was very striking.
But days passed by, and nobody came forward to identify the owner of the killer's hat, despite the huge reward.
A small box.
It was another Victorian fashion accessory that gave the police their next breakthrough. A small gold stud.
It was found attached to the victim's waistcoat. On it is a broken hook from where Mr. Briggs had once anchored his gold watch and chain.
It seems that Thomas Briggs was a victim of petty crime. This beloved old man was killed for a watch. At least this gave the investigation a trail to follow.
A photograph shows it hanging around Briggs's neck.
Anyone familiar with Victorian London knew where the stolen jewellery would probably be fenced. Cheapside. On the edge of the city banking district, it's now lined with glass-fronted office blocks. 150 years ago, it was full of shops.
Wearing a long coat, hat and carrying a cane, Wicks passes through a gate and heads down a set of steps.
Cheapside is one mass of life. The greatest, busiest street in London. Perhaps the world. It is as full of activity as a nest of vipers. There are tailors, shirt makers, tobacconists, and, above all, jewellers.
Most jewellers were also pawnbrokers. They exchanged valuables for cash, no questions asked. Here was the nucleus of Victorian London's black economy.
A black and white photograph of Cheapside shows the road filled with horses and carts.
It was Tanner's job to know Cheapside and the world that surrounded it. He put out word of the missing watch and chain.
A Cheapside dealer with a not inappropriate name came forward with critical evidence.
A business card for John and Robert Deeth.
Deeth stated a man called at his shop selling a gold watch chain. It matched the watch chain worn by Mr. Briggs on the night of his murder.
A drawing of Tanner at the jeweller's.
But Deeth didn't know the name of the man who fenced Briggs's watch and chain. The jeweller could barely provide a description of him. Tanner's foray into Cheapside had left him chasing shadows. Briggs had now been dead for a week. The early promise of the investigation seemed to have led the police into a dead end. The press grew impatient.
It was made clear that no stone could be left unturned, no agency unemployed to bring to justice the perpetrator of this crime.
Then, after more days of silence, someone came forward to claim the £300 reward. A cab driver called Jonathan Matthews said he knew whose hat Tanner had found.
A black and white photograph of Matthews sitting on top of a cab with a group of other men. It's night time when he slips into a building and enters a room where papers are lying on a desk. A candle on the table and a gas lamp provide some modest light in the room.
I had a new hat. And this friend, he saw my hat and said he would like to have one like it.
Did he look at it?
Yes. He put it on his head and said it was too small for him. But he said he should like one like it, and I said I would get him one if he wished it.
And you got him one?
Yes.
At what shop?
At the same.
What same? What shop?
At the hatter's.
Of course, but where?
Mr. Walker's, Crawford Street, Marylebone.
He lights a pipe.
Matthews identified the owner of the hat as a young German immigrant called Franz Müller.
He was working for a brother-in-law and came to dinner frequently, twice or three times in a month.
A portrait of Müller.
After one of these dinners, Müller had even given Matthews' family a portrait of himself. Calling cards with photos on were then the latest fashion. Tanner now had a name and a photo of a suspect. But along with it came disappointing news. This bird had flown.
Matthews said he didn't know where Müller was gone, but that Müller had told Mrs. Matthews, the cabman's wife, that he was going to America.
Matthews' account didn't entirely add up. He hadn't contacted the police until after Müller had disappeared. Matthews later claimed it was because he hadn't heard about the Briggs murder, despite it having been the talk of the town for a whole week.
When you're about in your cab, do you ever take a break?
Yes, occasionally, when I want something to eat.
Do you ever go into a public house?
Perhaps I may go in there sometimes. There's no harm in going into a public house to have a glass of ale.
Every day?
Yes, sir. Well, I've got to loiter about for hours in all weathers, so I'm none the worse for drinking a pint of beer.
Yet you never heard about the murder of Mr. Briggs?
No.
Do you take in a newspaper?
Sometimes I do.
Did you not see a paper from the 9th until the 15th of July?
Not to bring the murder into my mind, no.
A modern-day taxi pulls up on a nighttime street and a passenger gets inside. Now it's 1864 and Wicks is inside a hansom cab.
They are great readers of newspapers, the cabmen, and in this they devote themselves first of all to the police reports. I find it almost impossible to believe that Matthews is telling the truth when he says he knew nothing whatever about this before Friday.
The horse-drawn cab continues down a dark street.
Matthews was a shadowy character. In his trade, survival depended on being ruthless and cunning. Because the economy of the Victorian streets was an energetic free-for-all.
If a cabman sometimes overcharges a passenger quite often underpays a cabman. I find ladies the worst passengers. They are timid and obstinate and run into houses and send out their servants. We cabmen are neither worse than anybody else nor yet better. There's good and bad among us, like in any basket of eggs.
Perhaps Matthews was just spinning a yarn to get the £300 reward. For a Victorian cabman, money was always tight.
As to our earnings, that depends. The best day is one with a fine morning and a wet afternoon. The people come out and are caught. Mind, if the day begins wet, that's bad for cabs. Why, in the winter time, I've had 10 hours of it without so much as a single oat for myself.
Reading Matthews was extremely difficult for Inspector Tanner.
Matthews' manner appeared mysterious. There didn't appear any truth in him.
But one element of Matthews' story did ring true. He said that Franz Müller had come to visit after the Briggs murder, bearing a gift, a decorative box from Dieth the jeweller. This linked the young German to the stolen watch and chain, so Tanner felt there had to be something in the cabman's story. The police soon established that Müller had boarded a ship called the Victoria, part of the fleet that crossed the Atlantic carrying emigrants from Europe, hoping to make a fresh start in New York.
I reported to the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, my ultimate superior, that Müller was indeed a suspect. Then I left Euston Station for Liverpool. I sailed from there to New York.
A passenger dog.
We were able to publish the gratifying intelligence that the police were, beyond any doubt, on the track of the murderer of Mr. Briggs. We took a load of apprehension off a lot of minds.
Although he had a head start, Müller's ship, the Victoria, was wind-powered and would take over a month to reach America. He was about to be caught up by the Industrial Revolution.
A restless, stormy grey sea.
By 1864, there were steam-powered ships, which crossed the Atlantic in a fraction of the time it took a sailing ship.
Black and white footage of steam pistons.
Though he'd left after Müller, Tanner steamed into New York weeks before him. Now Tanner lay in wait for his prey.
A map of New York.
Müller made many mistakes, but his greatest was taking passage on a sailing ship. Even he must have known that if the police had alighted on the broad trail he'd left behind, that steam would frustrate his escape.
Müller's portrait lies on top of some paperwork.
Back in London, Müller, up till now an enigma, was becoming better known. A report sent to the Yard by the police in Germany states, "Reflecting on his character and conduct, nothing whatever has transpired to his disadvantage." But after coming to Britain, Müller slid almost to the bottom of Victorian London's steep social pyramid.
It seems that Müller was apprenticed as a gunsmith in his native country. He came over to England about 2 years before the murder of Mr. Briggs, and failing to find work as a gunsmith, he turned tailor.
A tailor stitching cloth.
Johann Hoffer was also a German immigrant. He'd once worked alongside Müller, and so was interviewed by the police. A German tailor's testimony gives us a glimpse of the life that Müller endured in what were unforgiving streets.
The German tailors in the eastern part of London are not that well off. It's a piecework system in the clothing factories, and production is incredibly cheap. We make these coats for 8 pence each. Trousers and waistcoats are made for 3 to 4 pence. I very often have to work all night, but slave as hard as I might, I never can get out of debt. What is to become of a society in which it is not possible for the hard-working worker to support himself, let alone a family? It's not surprising that people who live such an existence despair of their future.
You talk of despair. Might this have driven Franz Müller to murder?
Franz was always very well conducted in every respect. I never heard of him getting into rows or committing any assaults. He was kind.
A painting of a harbour.
Across the Atlantic, Müller breezed into New York Harbour on the 25th of August. He'd no idea the police were lying in wait for him.
I found Müller on board the Victoria. I remember he said to me, "What's the matter?"
And then what?
The American police officer I was with said, "You are charged with the murder of Mr. Briggs." And I followed up with, "Yes, on the North London Railway between Hackney and Bow on the 9th of July." Müller said, "I never was on that line." Then I took possession of the effects of the prisoner. In particular, I took hold of a hat. I asked Müller, "Is this your hat?" He said yes.
This is the hat.
It was not a hat a poor tailor would wear, but a gentleman's topper made from silk. What's more, it tied Müller even closer to the crime scene. The topper matched the description of the one taken from Briggs on the night of his murder.
I asked him how long he possessed it. He said about 12 months.
What did you say in reply?
I told him I should have to hold him as a prisoner.
The hat from the crime scene had made Müller a police suspect. The hat in his luggage seemed to confirm his guilt in the public
mind. The hat of the murdered man.
If it was true that the hat of the murdered man had actually been found on the prisoner's person, it would have been idle to entertain any doubt as to his criminality. So far as anything that is done in secret can be certain, we were certain that Müller committed this crime.
Tanner and Müller embarked for home together on an ocean liner. The two men shared quarters and seemed to have got to know each other on the 15-day passage.
I told him that it was usual to place prisoners of his class in irons, but that I didn't wish to put him to any discomfort. If, therefore, he would promise to comply with my requests, I should not iron him. I supplied him with books to pass away the time. I lent him first Mr. Dickens's hilarious Pickwick Papers, then two volumes of David Copperfield. Müller behaved himself well. He could not have been a better conducted prisoner.
Tanner and Müller's ship docked at Liverpool, from where they took the train south.
Now, returning to modern day, outside London Euston Station.
Müller's imminent arrival at London's Euston Station was somehow discovered beforehand.
Wicks walks through Euston.
A mob turned out to greet the young German.
Wicks enters a side room at the station.
Müller's arrival here was a tumult. 2 months before, there had been scarcely a human being in our vast metropolis more unknown than this waif and stray from a foreign land.
A photograph of Müller.
Poor Müller. To wake up one morning and find oneself famous. By strange fortune, this is what befell this obscure German tailor.
This was also the first time the press set their eyes on Müller.
A dull-looking young man, with a mouth like a slit cut into wood and eyes sunk deep under a low forehead.
On the 17th of September, 2 months after the murder of Thomas Briggs, Franz Müller was back in London under arrest. This was the end of Inspector Tanner's involvement in the first railway murder. It seemed that the case was closed.
We didn't know the precise circumstances of the deed, but that Franz Müller committed it was more certain than any human conclusion can be.
Tanner points to the train compartment window. Now a three-story brick building standing on the corner of a back street in modern-day London.
These London back streets were where Müller was imprisoned while he awaited his trial. It was scheduled for a month after his return. Though a pariah to many, Müller's predicament meant he did attract some supporters.
I consider Mr. Müller to be innocent of the crime and resolved to save no trouble or expense to prove him being not guilty.
Gottfried Kinkel was another German immigrant. He too had done time. He'd been imprisoned in his home country for rebelling against Germany's autocratic rulers. He'd escaped and had fled to Britain, where he'd become as well known as his fellow radical Karl Marx. Kinkel now became a leading figure in a group of influential Germans who tried to help Müller.
Gottfried Kinkel hurries down a flight of steps, past a woman sitting at a desk and along a passageway.
I first met Müller in here. I explained that we were undertaking his defense, that he had friends. When I told him a change of clothes had been provided for him, his lips quivered forth an expression of thanks, and his eyes filled with tears. Things were very bad for him. Well, Miller's whole demeanor was not that of a man who's guilty of murder. Well, his natural kindliness of temper never was seen to change. Yet it was supposed that this poor tailor got into a first-class carriage, able to murder or rob someone in a minute or two. Such a hypothesis was fallacious.
Müller's German supporters claimed the case against him was based on prejudice. Germans had initially been welcomed to Britain. By the 1860s, they were the second largest immigrant group in London. But in February 1864, Denmark, a British ally, had been invaded by Germany. Then attitudes had changed.
Müller was a German, and Englishmen of those days had been reading often enough in their papers that the war that we were carrying on was nothing better than burglary. So a German in English eyes was more likely to be a robber than not.
Müller's bad character was by now deeply etched into the public mind. Calling the case against him anti-German prejudice appears to have backfired.
With extraordinary obtuseness of feeling, Müller's defence was treated as one in which German honour was also on trial, and every sensible, unprejudiced man, be he a foreigner or an Englishman, must have considered this as impertinence. If some of the Germans residing in England were not happy with that, they had much better stay at home.
The corner of Newgate Street and Old Bailey.
On the 27th of October, 3 months after Briggs was killed, Franz Müller stood trial for the first railway murder at London's Old Bailey, the most famous criminal court in Britain.
The court's interior.
A Victorian courtroom contained little that looks like justice to 21st century eyes.
A photo of Müller.
In the 1860s, someone accused of murder wasn't allowed to say a word in their own defence, other than to enter their plea. Müller's plea was not guilty, and the punishment Müller faced if convicted was death by hanging in public.
A man places a judge's wig on a stand.
If ever there are cases in which care and caution need to be exercised, it's cases like this was, where life or death hung upon the balance. The jury had the transcendent power to bid that young man to live or to die.
John Parry was Müller's lawyer. He'd made a name for himself by winning sensational trials. Sir Gottfried Kinkel had raised the money to pay Parry to defend Müller. In court, Parry tore into the case against the young tailor.
The prosecution relied mainly upon three pieces of evidence. The watch and chain exchanged at Mr. Deeth's, the hat found in the railway carriage, next upon the hat found with the prisoner. Now, as regards the watch and chain, Müller never denied having been at Mr. Deeth's, but it does not follow he knew anything of the murder. He said he purchased those articles at the docks. Either the murderer or an agent of the murderer must have sold them to him. And the hat that is supposed to belong to Mr. Briggs, well, there are 1,000 just like it at the second-hand market. Müller said he'd had his 12 months. As regard the hat found in the railway carriage, Matthew's evidence was entirely unreliable. Does anyone believe he never heard of the murder for a week after it was in the newspapers? Matthews was evidently actuated by a desire to obtain the reward. That has animated his whole conduct.
A drawing of the court proceedings in progress.
The attempt to destroy the prosecution case hinged on Matthews becoming the villain of this story. Parry revealed to the jury that the cabman had debts and had done time for theft. It was a catastrophic miscalculation of the public mood.
I should be very wicked if I was not to admit a suspicion has pointed towards Matthews. But I should be very sorry to see him charged with being a party to the murder.
What is the imputation against Matthews?
What is the object of advertising a reward if you do not want anyone to be influenced by them? And if you are to disbelieve every man who gives evidence because of a reward, at once and forever cease to give rewards for the purpose of detecting great offences.
Matthews was regarded as a lovable rogue. His testimony was accepted and the case against Muller remained strong.
Nighttime traffic.
So Parry played his trump card, an alibi for Muller. Camberwell, in South London, was miles away from the scene of the attack on Briggs. Here, just off Vassal Road, where there is still a terrace of Victorian cottages, Muller was seen just minutes before the murder.
Inside one of the cottages.
Did you know Mr. Muller?
Yes. I met him a 12-month before.
Did you see him often?
An older woman.
He asks, did you see him often?
Yes.
Mary Ann Eldred, a young deaf woman, was Muller's sweetheart. She testified along with her landlady, Elizabeth Jones.
When was the last time you saw him? Before the 9th of July?
He says, when was the last time...
I met him on the Saturday preceding the 9th of July in Sheepstead.
And did you see him on the 9th? The night that Thomas Briggs was murdered?
I went out at 9 o'clock.
Mary Ann wasn't at home. She had gone out at 9 o'clock and she'd been out about half an hour. Muller called to see her and found she wasn't at home. He stayed talking with me about 5 or 10 minutes at the door. I'm quite sure it's as much as half past 9 o'clock. He then left.
Elizabeth Jones's testimony put Muller in South London only a few minutes before he was alleged to be killing Thomas Briggs in a train on the North London line.
I'm quite sure it was Saturday evening, the 9th of July, about 9:30, that I saw that young man. I thought his name was Muller. And he used to call him a little Frenchman. I didn't know he was a German. Mary Ann used to say that he was a German, but I used to call him the little Frenchman.
Parry's unveiling of an alibi was the first glimmer of hope for Muller in many weeks. But under cross-examination, another story emerged from behind this tale of a missed rendezvous with a sweetheart. Parry's key witness was exposed as a prostitute.
Mary Ann Eldred was what is called an unfortunate girl. But moral indignation ought not to press too heavily on her head. We all know well what is going on in all the classes, from the highest to the lowest.
Victorian London's sex industry was vast. There were an estimated 55,000 prostitutes, about one for every 20 adult men. What drove many women into prostitution was economic necessity.
I had worked at shirt making. The fine, full-fronted white shirt. I got 10p each for them. By working from 5 o'clock in the morning till midnight each night, I was able to do 7 in the week. This brought me to a profit of 15p. It stands to reason that no one can live, pay rent and buy clothes upon 15p a week. So I was forced to go out at night to make my living. I can, and I will solemnly state, that it was the smallest of the price for my labour that forced me to prostitution for a living.
Elizabeth looks a little uncomfortable.
Cruel to call them prostitutes.
I know how horrible this is. In my heart, I hate it. My whole nature rebels against it. And no one but God knows how I struggle to give it up.
Mary Ann and Elizabeth change bed linen.
Mary Ann Eldred's admission of prostitution was devastating for the reputation of Elizabeth Jones. It became clear that Jones was no ordinary landlady, but was running a house of ill repute.
Mary Ann Eldred. It was difficult to see her without feeling some compassion for the situation of life that she was in. But Mrs. Jones, someone who is living off the profits of such a calling, is about the most infamous of womankind.
In court, the judge advised the jury that they shouldn't trust Jones's testimony. Muller's alibi was in tatters.
The girl Eldred evidently did her best to save the life of the young man. And as she left the court, Muller looked at her with an expression of sincere gratitude.
A drawing of the court.
The trial lasted just 3 days. The verdict of the jury was that Muller was guilty of murdering Thomas Briggs. The judge passed a sentence of death by hanging.
The drawing depicts a judge with his head in his hands. Gottfried Kinkel enters an empty cell.
Gottfried Kinkel refused to give up the fight for Franz Muller. A petition was organised and sent to the Home Secretary begging for mercy.
Ivy creeps up the side of the Briggs family home in Hackney.
A delegation of Germans went to the Briggs home in Hackney. It was hoped that if the victim's family signed the petition, Muller's death sentence would be overruled. Refused entry, the Germans persisted. They waited on the doorstep for 45 minutes.
You cannot doubt that the widow and children of a murdered man would have been the last to wish to see an innocent man punished. But I put it to you, we should have been spared so indelicate and ill-timed an appeal. It was foolish, unwarranted, and cruel.
The Briggs family refused to meet the Germans. And the Home Secretary turned down Kinkel's appeal. Nothing could now save Muller from the rope.
A photograph of Muller behind bars.
What had begun in death, by the law which society these days maintains, also ended in death.
A montage showing the scene of Briggs's murder, Kinkel leaving the building where Muller was detained, Matthews smoking his pipe, Elizabeth and Mary Ann sitting together in their lodgings, Muller's lawyer Parry removing his wig, and the statue of Lady Justice above the Old Bailey.
Early on the morning of the 14th of November, 3 months after the death of Thomas Briggs, Franz Muller was prepared for his execution, watched closely by the journalist Frederick Wicks.
I remember it all as if it had occurred last week, and I believe I shall never forget it. The hangman was as quick in his movements as he was noiseless. Muller had his hands down at his sides in the most natural manner, and in this position, they were strapped down by a pair of leather handcuffs. The hangman then removed Muller's collar. With gruesome delicacy, he tucked this into the waistcoat. It was horrid.
Wicks's expression is somber.
But the horror was only just beginning. Muller was led out of his prison so that he could be hanged in public. Wicks, determined to keep on his story, went with Muller all the way to the scaffold. It was erected right here, between the Church of St. Sepulchre and the Old Bailey Courthouse across the road.
The chaplain led the way to the scaffold, reading the burial service, and the hangman then led Muller up a flight of about 10 steps, and I followed. Perhaps my presence on the scaffold was regarded as an intrusion, but nothing to me seemed more proper.
From up on the scaffold, Wicks had a condemned man's view of a judicial slaughter. 50,000 people came to see Muller hang.
A drawing shows the crowds gathered for the hanging.
The entire space in front of me presented an unbroken mass of human faces and every unholy passion that humanity is capable of.
A variety of expressions in the crowd.
The mouths of all the myriads of dirty yellow faces were open, and all the thousands of eyes upturned upon the spot where I stood. Meanwhile, the hangman put the rope round Muller's neck and tightened the slipknot just under his right ear. And last of all, he pulled a dirty yellow hood down over the man's head to his chin. He then stood aside. The priest continued to beseech Muller to confess his crimes, but Muller preserved the same stolid, unimpassioned manner that had characterized his attitude throughout. I stood just behind him as the drop fell. Then a movement, so slight it could scarcely be called a movement, but rather an almost imperceptible muscular flicker went through Muller's frame. This was all. And Muller had ceased to live.
A drawing shows Muller with the noose around his neck and the hood over his head.
But just before he died, Muller, up till then silent in this story, had finally spoken.
It was as he was launched into eternity that Muller gave his infamous last words. He spoke in German, "Ich habe es gethan." I am told this means, "I did it."
A steam train powers along the rails and multiple train tracks crisscross each other.
In a few years, the terror inspired by the first railway murder faded. The train became part of everyday life.
Steam billows out of a tunnel as the train passes.
For Inspector Richard Tanner, finding and capturing Muller was the highlight of his career. He died soon after, aged just 41. Gottfried Kinkel, the former revolutionary, founded London's only German-language newspaper. He never returned to his native country. The cabman Jonathan Matthews got the £300 reward for providing the information that led to Muller's arrest, but it was all swallowed up by his creditors. There is no record of the fate of Mary Ann Eldred, but the prospects of a Victorian prostitute were for a short and miserable life. Frederick Wicks became a notable writer and newspaper owner.
A photograph of Old Bailey Prison.
Franz Muller was buried beneath the Old Bailey Prison. It has since been knocked down and replaced with another court complex. But perhaps his bones lie here still.
Pedestrians and traffic outside the Old Bailey.
Unraveling the mysteries behind classic detective stories. Listen to She Done It on BBC Sounds.